You know, Mike, it's a matter of following the money. You have recapped it. We have filed what amounts to a probable cause memo with the IRS, recapping what you just said, and that's exactly what we're doing. We're following that path of money. And the path of money has led us to really what we call an ecosystem of people all related to one another, not familial, but in terms of political relationships, people having worked for years within administrations together. And it's really very troubling. You hear a term called deep state all the time. I don't know if I'm right or wrong when I give my definition of it, but here's our definition of it. And what we're witnessing in that ecosystem is a deep state approach to the accumulation of tax dollars, either by avoiding paying tax, so you keep it, i.e. nonprofit, or, as you just described, once taxes are collected, a redistribution through the channels you just described of tax dollars, where members of the ecosystem that we've identified, we know they are, we've got their names and numbers, we've got everything, are the beneficiaries of those collected tax dollars. It's kind of a bookended operation. You don't pay tax on one side, taxpayers do, and once you've collected taxpayers' dollars on the other side, there's a redistribution mechanism where it comes back to those same people who don't pay tax. You get it on both sides of the house. Very troubling. We've identified this throughout the 501c3 arena. This case we have filed has, as you know better than us, taken to the attention of people within the government. And maybe you can even talk to that better than we can. To the point where, if you look the case up, it's actually under seal, which is extraordinary that a publicly supported nonprofit entity in a case involving them is under seal. Why? There's nothing of personal tax returns. There's nothing personal about this. This is about an entity supported by the taxpayers. So that whole side of the case we can't speak to. But the cash flow that you're talking about and what's going on within that cash flow is what leads to a case like this being under seal. It's extraordinary that this should be under seal when the taxpayers are the ones who fund it, either through donation and or subsidy by not having to pay tax. So what one entity doesn't pay, if the government uses tax dollars, someone else has to pay. You're subsidizing them at the applicable federal and state tax rates.
Well, just real quick,
it's John. Extremely troubling.
John, just real quick. People out there saying, why can't we get all the details about these things? Why aren't Moynihan and Doyle talking about the details? You can't talk about the details because the folks who wanted it sealed, the folks who petitioned the court to seal it, is the IRS. They say, you got to lock this thing down. These guys filed this case. They have all these attachments. They have all these documents, tons of documentation. This can't be out in the public. We got to keep this quiet. So that's why it's sealed. It wasn't your choice. And two, then I'll let you guys talk. This is my style just to let people talk, but I just wanted to interject. I talked to guys in Justice, and they say DOJ is terrified of this case. The FBI and Treasury, the IRS, they had guys that were wanted to work this case and did work the case. But a guy like Barr, everybody thinks Barr is this guy, you know, he's a white hat, all this stuff. His DOJ is terrified of the case. They want to keep a lid on this. They want to keep it sealed. They're happy to keep a lid on it. So that's the feel I'm getting. It was described to me by one guy who's a nuclear bomb.
Well, the multiplier on this is extraordinary, because having done some of these 501c3 cases, to me, that is the deep state. Larry and I have done the research. This sector of nonprofits, $1.9 with a T, trillion dollars a year in the United States, $1.9 trillion dollars a year flows through this sector untaxed. $1.9 trillion. It's extraordinary, which includes universities and this and that. And everybody wants to know why we're broke. If you're a college town, if you're a city in America that has colleges and universities, everybody applauds and claps their hands and says, isn't this great? Well, we see so many universities involved in that case, recipients of funds. So these universities have endowments. They don't pay tax on the interest that they earn. Those same universities are receiving grants of tax dollars. Those universities are paying no real estate tax, even if they make a pilot payment in lieu of taxes. It's a percentage of what the rest of us are being taxed. And to cap it all off, after having paid no income tax, these folks ask for federal financial aid. They actually get financial aid as well. So when you look at those five points, all 501c3s, now you bring this to the Clinton Foundation and all these other foundations, $1.9 trillion, no tax. And everybody wants to know why the country's broke. That would be the 10th largest GDP unit in the world. In the world. That would be the 10th largest unit. We are watching chaos ensue in America right now. Okay? We need more money for this. We need more money for that. We need this. We need that. $1.9 trillion flows through this every year. And no one says anything about it. It's outrageous. That's the deep state.
$1 trillion. Okay? And you see, okay, who's one of the lead drug companies, you know, being promoted for this a vaccine? Gilead Sciences. Like, oh, they're on our board too, for, you know, distributing adulterated meds going all the way back. Gilead and Ranbaxy had licensing agreements, and you know, the Clinton Foundation, President Clinton goes out a month or so ago and says, you know, we've got to get involved with this contact tracing, and then all of a sudden, just a couple of weeks ago, okay, who's going to be the lead entity up in Massachusetts for contact tracing? An outfit called Partners in Health. Partners in Health, we blew the whistle on them in February of 2019. And so it's like our board suddenly has come to life.
They're on the whiteboard.
They are on the whiteboard.
And I are watching the television going, wait a minute. We're involved in the JV game, right? The varsity game's going on right before, so we're like, stop, wait a minute. So Larry and I start to go back and start looking at, wait a minute here, hold on a minute. Are these all the same companies? We go back, we're doing our research. These are the same people. Mr. Kim, who is the head of the World Bank, decides to leave the World Bank with his credentials, with his capabilities, with his contacts and what he's done, he could go anywhere in the world. Where does he end up? right up here in Boston, Partners in Health. Who's one of the senior directors on the board of directors of the Partners in Health, Larry?
Chelsea Clinton.
Chelsea Clinton. But like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. So let's take a look back. Has there ever been any time in history where this same group may have gotten together over this contact tracing, and what have you? Well, what do we find there?
Well, in August of 2019, there was a conference held in Rwanda, sponsored by the Aspen Institute. And who was at that conference? Representatives of the Gates Foundation, representatives of Partners in Health, Congressman Bobby Rush of Illinois. And Congressman Rush just so happens to be the lead for $100 billion legislative ask, H.R. 6666, on contact tracing. How convenient, huh?
So we're talking 4 months before the pandemic. These folks are all meeting in Rwanda. All the people who are getting the contracts are meeting in Rwanda 4 months before the pandemic. The timeline is not our opinion. These are the events that go on.
Okay, let's take a step back.
Let me one other point though, Michael, before that, because we've got other, you know, and Harvard University has obviously gotten jammed up because of this fellow Lieber, the Lieber Research Group Harvard. Harvard is on the board here as well. But there was one other very large so-called public charity, D.C.-based, the largest non-governmental recipient of funds from the Global Fund, called Population Services International, also a significant recipient of funds from USAID to the tune of approximately $900 million. And what business are they in? They're involved in they basically are a for-profit abortion franchising entity in these developing countries. I mean, it's just like, are you kidding me? So what's part of the ask? This $2.5 trillion, you know, UN-sponsored World Health Organization-led ask. What did they come out with just a couple of weeks ago? They said, okay, amongst all the, you know, the need for this funds for the coronavirus and humanitarian support, one of the essential services here, folks, is abortion. You know, that's going to be part of the ask too. And like, oh, how convenient. You know what? We got to get these folks from Population Services International involved as well. So it's just like, okay, you know what? Our whiteboard, it's not a close match with what's going on. It's basically an identical match with what's going on here currently.
It's extraordinary.
Substitute HIV with coronavirus and timestamp it. You know, June of 2020, and we drew these boards late 2018 going into early 2019. It's like, wow.
So it's the same scheme. It's just a different.
Just a different virus. Although, your interview with Dr. Mikovits talked about the fact that in this virus, because what's the primary virus that, you know, the Clintons were involved in? It was HIV, primarily. You know, there was some malaria and tuberculosis as well, but they get a lot of their notoriety for HIV. What did Dr. Mikovits talk about and others, the fellow over in France, that there are HIV strains in this coronavirus?
Yeah, that's a fact that's gone unreported. Nobody in the mainstream media wants to touch out with a 10-foot pole. Let me take one step back. You guys, John and Larry, you talked about this. I just want to go back over the steps again. I'm doing my Lieutenant Columbo thing where I circle back and I sound like an idiot. Let's talk about this contact tracing powwow 4 months before the pandemic. Who Clinton was involved? Let's just spend a couple minutes on that and go back over that, because I don't want that to be, I think that's very important.
To the best of our knowledge, we're not aware that there were representatives of the Clinton Foundation at this conference. It was a conference held in Rwanda, sponsored by an outfit called the Aspen Institute. Some of the primary funders of the conference were the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation. Those are the two names that I recall. And, you know, they're talking about a whole host of issues, but it's, you know, dare I say, convenient that Gates representatives are there, representatives of Partners in Health that end up getting the lead up in Massachusetts on contact tracing, and Congressman Rush from Illinois, who's leading the proposed legislation to fund this contact tracing, that they all, you know, they all happen to conveniently be in Rwanda, Africa, you know, 3 to 4 months before this virus starts getting legs over in China.
So you're talking about, huh? You're talking about the fall 2019, like September?
No, the conference was held in Rwanda in August of 2019.
Jesus Christ. Contact tracing.
Let's talk to them about this, right?
The thing that jumps out at me is a guy like Mr. James Kim, he has a resume where he can go anywhere in the world. Head of the World Bank. He ends up at a not-for-profit 501c3 that virtually no one's ever heard of, called Partners in Health, in Boston, Mass. And the next thing you know, they're winning a contract for contact tracing. I don't think that's a coincidence.
Yeah, and Jim Kim he's going to be their point person in terms of engaging governors around the country. And he went to Partners in Health from the World Bank, I think it was January or February of 2019.
But didn't Partners
in Health? This is a globalist ideology.
Oh, completely.
It really is. It's about the way we as human beings, from a population standpoint, Larry's talking about companies that are looking to vie for money out of this $2.5 trillion fund for population control. Obviously, Mr. Gates has been very involved in population control throughout the world, as Larry spoke to earlier. I don't know what contract tracing is about other than identification of population movement. I mean, this is a globalist, and they would believe themselves to be visionaries. This is a globalist mindset that the planet is being corrupted by people, and that this little cabal is going to take responsibility for it. It's just shocking, the level of vanity and egotistical views that are being espoused by these people. It's just outrageous.
Well, there you have it. Now compare it to this recent interview Fauci did with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. An obscure interview at best, and probably for a reason. And after the interview, we'll take you out with a little bit more tunes from Dropkick Murphys, and we say a belated thank you again to Moynihan and Doyle for showing us the way. Maybe I should play some Peter Frampton. Maybe I'll play Frampton. Show me the way, whatever it is. Listen to this. Compare it to what we just talked about. Meld it with the intro I did. So I think I did a damn good job of, by the way, summarizing a 2.5-hour interview. And you'll understand we are in the midst of something that's taking a long time to put together. Many moving parts. This is not something organic. Just like we talked about in the past, the quote-unquote virus itself being cooked up by some bats, it's silly at this point. These are seasoned international schemers with a license to steal and kill, by the way. And kill, as we found out. Get in the know, folks. Wake up. Spread this around. Share it with people. Again, the Moynihan and Doyle interview is from June 2020. Not 2021. 2020. If you want to reference the entire Moynihan and Doyle podcast, it's on thomaspaynepodcast.com. You'll see it. We replayed it in a couple different parts, two or three parts or four parts in the last month or so. Go down the board there and you'll see it. Moynihan and Doyle. Probably repost it this weekend as well on the podcast, the original, so you can listen to that. And meld it with this. I'll say to you now, early, take care and God bless. We'll go into Fauci and then the end song and voila.
Allowed us to use money from the American Rescue Plan to get that $3.2 billion as really a good start. I think that success will breed greater enthusiasm for more support. And that's exactly what happened with the HIV program. Nothing convinces the source of resources to give more resources than success. So if we come up with success, I think we will get more. Obviously, if you want to have a program that's sustainable over a period of time, you're going to want more money. But 3.2 is very generous, and we're very pleased with it.
Thank you. Now, tell us a bit about what you see as the ideal or optimal product profile. What does a product have to look like in order to be a winner, in your view, when you take into consideration use, equity considerations, access? What are you telling people is the optimal profile?
Okay. The optimal profile, we're comfortable with this because we've developed product profiles for so many other drugs, including with HIV. So first of all, I want a pill that blocks a specific viral function. I want to give it once a day, if possible. I want it to be low in toxicity, and I want it to have very minimal drug-drug interactions. So orally administered, single pill, given for 7 to 10 days, little drug-drug interaction, and low toxicity. Give me that, and I'll be really happy.
And what about scalability, ease of use, and access to populations?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, we want to do with this what we did with PEPFAR. I mean, that's the model, that you get a product that you can make, give it. I mean, the companies are going to be involved with us. I mean, I hope that we can get arrangements, given the investment that the federal government has made, that we could have reasonable pricing so that we can make it available throughout the world, the same as we're trying to do with the vaccines. We don't want to have a situation where people in low and middle income countries don't have access to this. So it's got to be able to be scalable, not something that has a process of development that has 25 separate steps in it, that you can't translate that to being done in other parts of the world.
So you build that into the initial agreements with industry partners in terms of creating a pathway to reach all Americans who need this, but also to reach low and middle income countries down the road.
That has always been an important part of everything we do. If you look at what we built into the vaccine program, equity has been one of the most important aspects of it, both domestic equity and now international equity. And that's the reason why, as you know, the Biden program has already committed $500 million plus $80 million that's going out right now. I'm pleased. I want to say this because I think the listeners should hear that. I'm pleased to see that we already have millions and millions of doses that have already gone out to Africa. Just this past week, we sent 5 million doses to South Africa. We're sending doses to other African countries. We want to do the same thing when you're dealing with therapy. We want to make sure we have international accessibility as well as domestic equity.
You talked earlier about the antiviral program fits within a comprehensive strategy that addresses both vaccines, diagnostics, and therapies. So are we going to see sometime soon a kind of formal rollout of a pandemic preparedness strategy that sort of embeds the development of therapies as a vital element of that and sets sort of targets in terms of trying to create the kind of ever warm capacities and stockpiles that we're going to need?
The answer is yes. We are in active discussion right now, sometimes sensitive discussions about amount of resources. So I would rather not give you granular details of that right now, Steve. But you know me and you know what my intentions are. And to the extent that I could have any influence on it, there will be a broad, comprehensive approach to pandemic preparedness and response at every level.
Thank you. I want to turn to the international context. You know, when you look at vaccines, we have an international entity, CEPI, Coalition Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, which is charged with doing upstream development of vaccines that fall outside of market incentives for dangerous pathogens. We have Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, at the other end of the spectrum that's there for procurement, distribution of vaccines and partnerships with countries, and the COVAX facility, most of it's being run right through Gavi as the principal partner there. We don't have institutions of that kind. We have a collection of different actors at those two ends of the spectrum when we talk about therapies, when we talk about antivirals. Are we going to need something like CEPI and Gavi when we're looking at therapies into the future internationally?
The answer is yes, Steve, and I think a good example of what we did with HIV. The HIV model is good. You know, we had the Global Fund, of which the U.S. government is a third of and has been from the beginning. We have the PEPFAR program, and that has worked very closely with groups like the Clinton Health Access Initiative. So that was kind of the CEPI and the Gavi of HIV, namely of therapy. So I would imagine that I can see something like that falling into place when you're dealing with therapies, something along the lines of what you mentioned, Gavi, CEPI, but some international access organization very similar to what the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton Health Initiative, has done for therapies for HIV.
The Global Fund's getting very active in, across this whole spectrum of things. We've just given them quite a large grant through the AARP funds for non-vaccine response in low and middle income countries. Are you expecting the Global Fund's going to be a big partner as if we get winners in this process in terms of therapies?
You know, that's a possibility, Steve. I mean, I can't say that that's going to happen, but it certainly is a reasonable question to ask, and I think it would be a possibility. Remember when the Global Fund got set up, it was started off to be the Global Fund for HIV, and then we expanded it to malaria and tuberculosis. I think there's no reason to think that it isn't possible to include in that pandemic preparedness.
Yes, well, that's a big debate there within their own board, and they're expanding. They've expanded some significantly, and they've been very nimble and fast in that regard. And so I would expect them to play. What about the Europeans? The EU is pre-purchasing some of these therapies that are, you know, in development. They've announced they're going to set up a new institution, HERA, HERA, as a counterpart to our BARDA institution. What role do you see them playing, and how does what we're doing link to that?
Well, I'm pleased to say that we are and have been and will continue to be in conversations with each of these players, specifically, you know, with Jeremy Farrar at Wellcome. a good friend and colleague in a lot of what we do. We've been involved in discussions there with Unitaid, with Intrepid, with the Global Fund. So we're trying to define how we can all work together on this, because this obviously is something that has international implications. So the answer to your question is there will be involvement with those entities that you mentioned.
Show me.